We're in Luke 8. We've been actually working through Luke 8 for the last few weeks. And here we are at Luke 8, verse 40. And as I think many of us here know, there is nothing like spending a few days in the Bristol Children's Hospital to have a sense of what it's like to feel deeply helpless, to experience human helplessness firsthand. Parents are used to doing pretty much everything for their children, helping them in all sorts of ways. But when you sit at the bedside of your child in Bristol Children's Hospital, or whatever hospital you find yourself in, one thing you are overwhelmed by is that sense of powerlessness in yourself to change their situation. Now, I realise that's a rather gloomy subject on which to start here on this happy day when we've baptised Rudy, where we celebrated and thanked God for the gift of giving him to us. But the truth is that the threat of illness, of injury, of death hangs over all of us, and our background, our talents, our achievements count for nothing when it does come to death. All of us are under its power. The prophet Isaiah speaks of it like being like a shroud, a covering that hangs over all people. And it's probably right to say that for many people today, the presence of death, of suffering, the need to have hospitals in the first place really seals the question on whether God exists or not. If God is God, the argument goes, if he really is God, if he's the God you Christians speak of one who is wholly good and only love, then why is there so much suffering in this world? If he's not powerful enough to do anything about it, well then he can't really be God, can he? He can't really be there. I guess we could put it a bit like this. In a match-up between God and something like terminal cancer seems to win every time. Sure, there are always stories of miraculous healings, but if you're sceptical, you know, you can write those off as just weird anomalies. And we all know that what people mean. We know what they mean when someone gets a diagnosis of terminal cancer and they say, well, he's going to beat this. He's a real fighter. I think they said that of John McCain when he was diagnosed a few months ago. And we all know what people say when they mean when they say that. But of course, we all know that being a fighter doesn't really make any difference when cancer gets a grip of your body. When death comes knocking, we are powerless to do anything about it at all. And the truth is, though, that even those of us who are Christians and say we want to live by faith, in reality, there's a part of us which really lives by fear. Low-level fear of bad news, of what might be around the corner. I live in fear of the phone going from Claire, my wife, and there's bad news. Some bad news from the school, or something, oh, such and such has been taken into hospital. There's been a car accident, something terrible. Well, here we meet a man who has received news like that. A man called Jairus. He's a person of high standing in the community. He's a synagogue ruler. And so he would have been a mover and a shaker. But here he is. We find him on his knees before Jesus, pleading with him to come to his house where his daughter lies dying. And Jesus agrees to go, and a crowd follow. In fact, they're jostling. They're not so much following. They're pressing in on him. You can imagine them going down the winding streets of whichever town they happen to be in. And there are people there trying to get in on Jesus. And yet, on the way, they're interrupted by someone. By a woman suffering from some kind of chronic menstrual bleeding. Like Jairus, she is similarly helpless. We're told that for 12 years, verse 43, 12 years she suffered, and no one could heal her. In fact, there's a little footnote that after 12 years, you can look down right at the bottom, she had spent all she had on doctors. That's another variant on the text. All the money she spent on doctors, no one could help. No one could stop this constant bleeding. She's 12 years, and things about Jairus' daughter, we're told just a bit further up in the passage, she was 12 years old. think Luke mentions this to suggest there's a link between these two situations. And certainly the way he weaves the story of Jairus and then this woman, then we'll go back to Jairus. You know, the way he weaves them together suggests he wants us to reflect on the connection between these two people. These two humans who are caught up in the mess of a fallen world. A world that is not as it should be. A world that is ravaged by sin, which is the Bible term for humankind being in rebellion against its maker. You see, the conviction of every book of the Bible, every author of the Bible shared the same presupposition, that death is not just a fact of life, no, it is an invasion. It doesn't have a place here. It isn't natural, and it isn't something that we should just stoically accept. And we all know that, don't we, in our hearts? When death comes, we rail against it. It is an invasion. It shouldn't be here. And the Bible says, the writers of the Bible say unequivocally, yes, because it is a sign that we are out of sync with our Creator. Now, as well as death, there were some bodily functions, or bodily dysfunctions, that the Lord designates in the Old Testament as being ritually unclean. That's the phrase that's used. That are signposts of humanity's fractured relationship with their God. And Leviticus 15 makes clear that menstrual bleeding was one of those signposts. So here we have a woman who for 12 years didn't just have to suffer with a horrible illness. No, she also had to bear the shame of being chronically unclean, of being ritually kind of seen as outside of the people of God, who would have had to live on the margins of society as a result, who would have permanently felt a distance from the God she believed in. And yet here she is, and she's seeking Jesus out. She's pressing in. She comes up from behind him, and she reaches and she touches the fringe of his cloak. And in an instant, she is healed. What for 12 years, a whole succession of doctors have been unable to do, this one touch of Jesus' cloak achieves in a moment. Jesus stops in his tracks. And he says, "Who touched me?" Verse 45. "Master, there are people crowding and pressing against you," said Peter. But Jesus said, "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me." It's a funny phrase, that, isn't it? Power has gone out from me. But it underlies the point that Luke is making right throughout chapter 8 of his gospel. And that is that Jesus has unique power in himself. He is in a class apart from any other human. He has power. The woman realizes she's been discovered, so trembling she comes back before Jesus. She falls at her feet, just like Jairus had done, and she testifies to what had happened. And again, the point is she says, "Look, it happened instantaneously." Verse 47, how she'd been healed instantly. And just look at what he says to her in verse 48, because it is deeply significant. He says, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." Now, the reason that's significant is he said exactly the same thing, just over the page back in chapter 7, to a woman who was probably a prostitute. She was kind of characterized here as a sinful woman. But she comes up to him and anoints Jesus with oil. And Jesus says to her in chapter 50 of verse 7, or chapter of Luke 7, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." Your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Your faith has healed you. Go in peace. The word is the same. Save, heal. It's exactly the same in Greek. And the idea here is really important. It's that healing and salvation are kind of being interwoven by Luke. He's saying that what we see in this woman being healed of her menstrual bleeding is not so much a healing, it's a picture of salvation. It's a saving that's going on. Because this woman with a bleed is the same as the woman who's a sinful woman, who's the same as all of us. All of us are in the same boat. We are, as it were, in need of forgiveness. We are in need of healing, of salvation. And it's why Jesus' words to the woman in chapter 7, the woman in chapter 8, to all of us who trust Christ is exactly the same. And it's so stunning. He says, go in peace. Go in peace. And peace in Luke's gospel is always forgiveness with God. Know that you are not at loggerheads with God anymore. He has forgiven you. He physically heals this woman, but then he says, know that you're forgiven. Much more significant. Even though you live in a world that is broken, even though you felt the brokenness in your own body, be assured you will not face judgment at all. So we have a picture here, Luke 8, of salvation. It's a sign. A sign that when Jesus saves a person, he's not just about saving their soul. No, salvation affects the whole person. It's a restoration. Can't help thinking of that hymn that we often sing, very well known. The first line is, praise my soul, the King of Heaven. And I think the second verse, you have this great line, ransomed, healed, restored, forgiven. Who like me his praise should sing? That is salvation. Ransomed, healed, restored, forgiven. It's far more physical than we think it is. We often hear of salvation, Christian salvation, and people think, oh, this is some sort of Disneyland in the sky where you sort of float up to when you die. No, salvation is about the healing of the whole person, the restoration of the whole person. In fact, as we've seen in Luke 8, restoration of the whole of creation. Jesus has come to still a storm, to order this world. He's come to cast out the demons. We saw that last week. Now we see a healing in every sense, putting this world right, putting us right. Oh, it's wonderful. You sort of want to think on it, mull on it, but there's no time, because even as he's saying this, bang, someone come, Jesus is interrupted, isn't he? Look at Luke 8, just have a look, verse 49. While Jesus was still speaking, just saying those precious words, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler, saying the words which every parent dreads to hear. Your daughter is dead. Don't bother the teacher anymore. Imagine Jairus' desolation and utter. He would be distraught at those words. But Jesus right away says, don't fear. Don't fear this news. It's news that all parents dread. Believe. Literally, sort of trust me. Why? Because she will be healed. Staggering words. No figure in all of history is recorded as saying anything as bold like that with a straight face. How can Jesus say it? Well, it's because of who he is. There's all the power of God coursing through his veins, and he's come to do what God promised in Isaiah he would do. We talked of the shroud covering all people, the shroud of death. Here we see that covering, that cloud being dispelled, being taken away, saying, do not fear, she will be healed. And he's not just saying, get ready to see her resuscitated. No, he's saying healed. It's that word again, healed, saved, same word. He's saying, Jairus, get ready for me, get ready to see salvation at work. So they walk to the house. They get there. The professional mourners are there. And they're wailing in that traditional Middle Eastern kind of way. You often see it on the television when tragically you see people mourning at funerals. There's all sorts of quite demonstrative wailing. Wailing was going on then. He says, look, don't wail. She's not dead, but she's asleep. Goodness, what a thing to say. Verse 52. Well, they find that frankly laughable. Literally, they laugh at him for saying that. And it's a sinister laugh. It's a mocking laugh. It's a laugh that says, we know better than you. She's dead. That's why they're laughing, kind of verse 53, knowing that she was dead. And it's the laugh of a mocker who basically kind of cannot entertain the prospect of anything beyond this world that we can see and touch, of a higher power. It's so contemporary, because don't we see it today? So often it's easy to kind of not consider the claims of Jesus in any meaningful way, just to kind of laugh them off as kind of just anyone who follows him and his, it's just kind of it's primitive. It's make believe. Not gonna entertain any of that in any serious sort of a way. Jesus said she's not dead but asleep, and sure enough, he goes and wakes her up just as you would wake a child. He goes in, takes her by the hand, and says, "My child, get up." Bang, she wakes up. And there she is, right up. She doesn't wake up, she's stood up, she's back on her feet. And Jesus says, "Look, give her something to eat." This is not a kind of a slow, this is a total transformation in a moment. You never want to eat when you're ill. And just, she's ready to eat, she's up on her feet, restoration completely. A few years ago, you maybe went and saw it. I think back at the year 2000, that kind of time, the National Gallery ran an art exhibition called "Seeing Salvation." All these images of Christ throughout history, kind of brought together. A really stunning exhibition. Well, here in Luke 8, we have his version of seeing salvation. If you've been with us the last two Sundays, you'll know. This is kind of week three. We saw in the first week, middle of chapter 8, Jesus stilling a storm. He subdues nature. He brings salvation, as it were, to nature, to the world. And then last week, thousands of demons he exorcises. And now, so it was the disordered creation, demons, now it's disease and then death. All these things that are terrible consequences of humankind from the very beginning saying no to God, wanting to live in this world without him, all the consequences that have come into this world being deleted, being overturned. Jesus is doing in microcosm form is kind of pressing rewind on all that's gone wrong with the world and restoring his people. And Jesus, and Luke is saying, look at it. This is salvation. You're seeing salvation in microcosm form. Look at the scale of it. Don't let anyone sell you short. Don't let anyone water you it down when you hear of salvation as though it's just some kind of saving of your soul, some kind of ticket to heaven. No, this is the salvation we mean when we talk of salvation from the Bible. We live in a rented house, and we used to have a massive great tree in the middle of our garden. It dominated the garden. It was a huge great fir tree. And just before we moved in, the landlord said they'd remove it, which is brilliant. And they did. But ever since, the area where this massive great fir tree has been, which is right in the middle of the garden, has been a total mess. If you come around, you might have seen it and bemoaned how lazy I am for not trying to sort it out. But I haven't tried to sort it out for 3 years now. And I'm to be honest, I have gone out there and tried to sort of tinker with the area a bit, you know, do some digging. I've done quite a lot of digging, actually. But the problem is, the garden's on a slope. There's this sort of funny little kind of stone wall in the middle of the garden. And the whole root system of the tree was left in. And I thought the root system just died. But frankly, it doesn't. It just keeps on kind of these huge, these really, if you leave it for a few months, these great big shoots come up. Anyway, there's some landscaping issues I've had. Anyway, but wonderfully, really, really, we're very fortunate. But recently, the landlord said, well, "We're going to get a landscaper in for you and finish the job. We're going to." And he came round and he did some drawings, chatted about, "Oh, I need to get some more landscapers in to help here. We need a rotavator skip. We'll need a whole lot of fresh topsoil. Blah blah blah." And then he left. Okay, I'll be back. I'll come back to do it. Left with a promise to return. Now, in truth, it was quite a long spell. He has returned, but it was quite long. But after that first visit from the landscaper, I haven't bothered sort of tinkering anymore with it. I've known, you know, I am pretty helpless, hopeless when it comes to anything like this. It's okay though. We've had a taster in microcosm of the restoration that's going to come about, and it certainly will come when this man returns. And he did this week, which is great. And in a silly sort of way, it's a picture of what we're getting here. What Luke is wanting to assure us of. We're seeing in microcosm the beginnings of restoration. He Here, look at these. Look at this, he's saying. Look at this. Look at this event. Look at this event. Four events. Four restorations that point us to the fact that the ultimate restoration is most certainly coming. It will come through this man, Jesus. Now, anyone can be a part of what he's going to do. Anyone can join in the salvation. But there is one requirement. And that is we need to give up on ourselves. We need to turn to Jesus in faith. In helpless dependence upon him. See, Luke is very clear. Jesus was not some magician. You just touched him and then you were healed. No, you needed to come to him in faith. This woman's touch was different from all the other of the people who were touching him. Because they weren't wanting to get his signature. Or they, no doubt, were wanting healing or wanting all sorts. But this woman was healed. She came with faith. She came trusting him to do a miracle. She puts all her hope in him. She faces up to her absolute kind of hopelessness and turns to him. And I think really she's being held as a model here. This is what Christian faith looks like. Complete lack of confidence in self and a complete resting upon Jesus Christ for our well-being, both now and forever. And Jesus calls on Jairus to do exactly the same thing. Exactly the same. Verse 50. In the face of the most devastating news he could have possibly had. Just imagine how he would have felt as he walked with "Your daughter is dead" ringing in his ears. As he's walking there, he also had Jesus' words. Don't be afraid, just believe. Just believe. So he walked with Jesus beside him, trusting that promise. So we have, in a sense, two people. One, a man at the centre of society. One, a woman on the edges. Both united in their utter helplessness. And here we're seeing that helplessness, feeling helpless, is not the great issue that we middle-class people feel it really is. We needn't fear helplessness. Feeling out of our depth, feeling powerlessness, is the basic characteristic of anyone who's truly Christian. Because it is the soil in which true faith really grows. Because yes, we are helpless. Helpless in the face of death, in the face of this scary world where anything could happen today. Helpless too in the face of our sin. Of that, like the woman had, that constant sense we all have if our conscience is alive, of uncleanness before God. And here we're seeing that we can trust, in this sense of helplessness, we can trust and have confidence of salvation. Now, just have a look, just as we come to a close, what faith is set against in, where are we, verse 50. It's set against fear. Don't be afraid, just believe. I think, I'm really speaking here to the regulars rather than the first timers or visitors, but just, I do want to say a word on this, because I think we as a church should be better at calling out fear for what it is. In a way, it's a respectable sin. Kind of anxiety about things, about life. You know, it's kind of, oh yeah, I'm a bit of kind of stress, concern. It's kind of okay to have, you know, if you're Christian. It's kind of respectable in one sense. We know we shouldn't do it, but it's okay. But here we're seeing it is very, very serious. Let's call it out for the serious lack of faith that it is. We mustn't allow persistent anxiety and fear about life to go unchallenged, because it is a distortion of Jesus. It's a failure to see him in his right proportions. If you find yourself grappling with constant nervousness about something, and perhaps you might say, because of the particular example here of a dying child, you might say about anxiety about your children, the answer is not really to think on Jesus' love, but to think on his size. Ask our Father in heaven to help you see Jesus as he really is. Big. He is bigger than anything we might face. So our life, our death, the life of our family, the death of our family is safe in his hands. Because this passage does not mean that disease and death will never come upon Christians. As a church, what are we? We're about 6 years old since we got established. We haven't yet faced the death of anyone in our congregation, but one day it will happen. Maybe one of us will receive a diagnosis that it's coming very soon. It's going to happen. It's just a matter of time. Death hangs over us all. And even, we just say on this day, yes, even for Rudy. And that's why we must do all we can to be a church that presents the Lord Jesus as we see him here in Luke 8. To Andy and to Ross, to Rudy as he grows up. To one another. So that the life we live now is one that is will have a note of confidence that death and all that's bound up with it doesn't have the final say. That one day all of us who trust in Jesus will wake from death, find ourselves transformed in a sin-free, pain-free, death-free world. That is the message of the gospel. As well summarized by, I think, C.S. Lewis, who at the end of his Chronicles of Narnia kind of ends like this. He talks about all their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had been the cover and the title page. And now, at last, they were at the beginning of chapter one of the great story, which no one on earth had read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before. The gospel cries out at us that this life that feels all everything is just the title page and the cover. There lies a great story ahead for all who trust in Christ. Let's think on these things for a moment, and then I'll pray.